pleased now to welcome an old friend to this podcast, Simon Dingle, former tech journalist, entrepreneur, crypto expert, and general Uber geek. I think I can describe you like that, Simon, as well as his co-conspirator in a new book, Stephen Boyke Sidley, who is an award-winning novelist, playwright, and columnist, who also happens to know a hell of a lot about finance and technology. Together, Simon and Stephen have authored a new book. I've got a copy of it here. It's called Beyond Bitcoin, Decentralized Finance and the End of Banks. That's quite a title, and I'm really looking forward to unpacking this book in a little bit of detail with our two authors now. But first of all, let me welcome you both to the podcast. How are you both doing? And thanks for making the time.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks, Duncan. Lovely to speak with you again.
Thanks, guys. So let me ask you, Simon, why did you write this book?
Because Stephen asked me if I did with him. No, it's Duncan. The last time we spoke on your show, I had just put out my first book in Math We Trust, which was all of, I guess, 4 years ago now. Wow. What's really amazing is how outdated that book seems now. You know, 4 years is nothing in the greater scheme of things, but in the crypto industry, that's an eternity. You know, and back then the term DeFi hadn't even been coined yet. So while we had notions of decentralized finance and some of the first protocols, etc., there wasn't even a word for it. I think it was really Stephen who put all the pieces together and said, there's somebody needs to converge on the story around what's happening with decentralized finance, what it means for our existing financial institutions, and really explain it in a way that's approachable, succinct, that makes sense, because there's a lot of confusion and misunderstanding around. So I thought that was a brilliant idea. And that was the beginning of the collaboration that turned into this book.
Okay. I know, Simon, you've been involved in the crypto space for some time. You were involved with Luno and various other projects over the years, and crypto has been a passion of yours for quite some time. But Stephen, you're a novelist and a playwright. How does a novelist and a playwright end up in the DeFi and crypto space?
Well, I have two sort of contradictory and legs to my life. The one is writing, where I've been writing novels and plays and columns for quite a long time. But I also was the group chief technology officer worldwide for Anglo American and Altec, and then went into mergers and acquisitions. So I have an MS in computer science. So I understand the stuff from the bit level up. Right. So it seemed like a sort of a nice combination to take on this particular subject. I wanted to add to what Simon said. It was clear to both Simon and I as early as 2020 that this thing called DeFi, this decentralized finance, was going to be a transformative technology, and perhaps even a more transformative technology than Bitcoin. And in early 2021, we did a sort of an unscientific poll of friends of ours who were in the banking industry, including people up at the top at board level and exco level. None of them had ever heard of DeFi.
Right.
Which both shocked me and was a catalyst for writing the book. By June 2020, everybody had heard of it, thought it was poison and kryptonite and it would blow up. By January 2022, every single major bank in the world was in it.
Right,
so the timing was about right.
Well, the good news is I have heard of DeFi. I'm no expert on the subject, though. I have dabbled in cryptocurrencies in the past few years, and actually made quite a bit of money out of Bitcoin. But I can't tell you that I'm any expert on DeFi, although I have learned a lot reading your book, and I highly recommend it to anyone who's interested in the space. It's well written. It's in simple language that even idiots like me can understand. And it really sort of delves into how this technology could actually upend the world. And it's fascinating reading. So I highly recommend going to check out this new book. Where is it available, by the way? Can you get it in local bookstores?
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's on five continents. It's in everywhere from exclusive to the smaller bookstores. It's on Loot, Takealot, Amazon, and all the major countries in the world. It's a global release out of London.
Fantastic. I believe there's an Audible version as well for people like me who struggle with
the Audible version, Kindle version, and a print version. Yeah.
Fantastic. Great. So I'm really good at unpacking what the concepts are here, but I want to delve into them in some detail in this podcast. But let's start with brass tacks, Simon. Decentralized finance, or DeFi, what is it exactly, and why is it so important?
Well, really, we're talking about taking everything that happens in the traditional financial world and decentralizing it using this force multiplier of blockchain technology, or crypto. And really for me, that is, in the broader sense, is the internet doing to money what it's done to just about every other industry. You know, we saw the internet brought to bear on the media industry and what that meant for newspapers. We saw it brought to bear on photography and what that meant for Kodak, you know, and, yeah, and the traditional ways that we used to share photography. We saw it brought to bear on communications and what that meant for our traditional postal systems, et cetera. And so you've really seen the internet impact every industry on earth that deals with information transmission. Mm-hmm. But money was kind of late to the game, if you will. And for me, crypto is really the internet doing to money what it's done to all these other industries. So, what happened to newspapers? I've got news for the banks because their turn has come. And so to me, that really is the headline, and decentralized finance, or DeFi, is just a term that captures us using the internet to do to the financial industry what it's done to everything else.
Right. So it sounds like bad news if you're a banker, but I want to get into that in quite a bit of detail. But Stephen, sorry, you wanted to say something?
Yeah. So when DeFi started, it was somewhat an accident and an inevitability of history. What really started the whole thing is that Vitalik Buterin, who, for those of your viewers don't know him, is a skinny Russian-Canadian teenager who started the Ethereum blockchain. And the Bitcoin blockchain had been running for about 4 or 5 years when he started it. And his big idea was to add a programming language on top of a blockchain-like system. He called it Ethereum, put a programming language on top of it. And some of you may have heard of the term smart contracts, which are just simply small programs written in that programming language. And he just simply presented this to the world. He said, well, now I've also got a blockchain called Ethereum, but I've also got a programming language. So you out there, from a teenager in your garage all the way up to a big corporation, please dream up what you would like to build on this thing. Mm-hmm. And it so happened that the industries with the biggest targets on the back were the financial industries, the banks, insurance companies, the stock exchanges. And people started building a smarter, better, faster, cheaper version of the services that we know: loans, deposits, insurance, how to buy and sell stocks, cheaper, faster, better, and fairer. What happened over and above that, because I wanted to add one more definition to what DeFi is that a bunch of services, a bunch of projects arose that offered financial services that are simply unavailable in the traditional world. So there were some that did a better job, a cheaper job, a fairer job, faster job of traditional services, and there were some that were brand new services that the traditional world has no way to compete with. And perhaps we can get into that in a little bit.
Sure. So I wanted to touch on something I picked up in the book. You speak about the concepts of trustlessness, decentralization, and permissionlessness as key to this new financial world. And you also say that this is the opposite of the world of financial institutions as we know them. Can you just expand a little bit, Stephen, what you mean by that?
So I'm going to do this quickly. I'm going to start off and scare you because it's going to think like I'm going to ramble for a couple of hours. But the first bank started in about 1200. It was the Medici banks, and the Medici banks took in people's jewelry and other valuables while the soldiers went off to war. And at a certain point, a little bit later, they felt they could loan out some of these valuables and charge people for the loan. And therefore, you had the beginnings of the banks, which was deposits and loans. And that Medici Bank was trusted. It was a trusted entity because the Medicis had a name, they had a reputation, they weren't going to steal your money. And banks have grown around the concept of trust us. The concept of a blockchain is that it's built out of mathematics. You do not have to trust mathematics. It simply is. And the parts of finance where finir carré happens, traditional finance, where theft happens or loss happens, is usually the mistake of human error, because humans are not trustworthy. They are fallible. Mm-hmm. They can be bribed. They can be threatened. A mathematical algorithm requires none of that. It can't be bribed. It can't be threatened. It can't fail because it's tired. So the word trustlessness is applied to the fact that the blockchain is built out of a set of mathematics. It's very complex mathematics. It has to do with cryptography and digital signatures and all sorts of things. But for the purposes of explanation, it does not have to be trusted, and therefore it is trustless. Permissionlessness, which is the next one that you mentioned, is that you do not need permission from anybody to interact with these DeFi protocols. You do not need KYC. You do not need to have an ID. You do not need to put your photograph on. You don't have to go through Rika. You don't need the permission. I'll give you a very good example of this. In a stock exchange, if you sign up to a stock exchange, like many of us are, and you want to trade large amounts of money, you're not allowed to, unless you can prove to the regulator that you are worth a lot of money. So if you want to do 10 million rand trades, I wish I was in that position, I'm not, you've got to prove that you have that money to trade. So permission is in many levels, permission to enter the system, permission to trade certain levels. We're treated like children by the traditional finance system. You need none of those provisions in DeFi. The last one you mentioned was decentralization.
Yeah.
It is the nature of things that because of those Medici banks and the way that those industries grew, everything coalesced on a center because the center could be trusted to handle your money and give it back to you when you needed it back. And that centralization became so watertight, so hermetically sealed that you could look under the hood and take a look inside and say, I want to see what goes on here. Why is my interest rate so high on my loan? Why is it so low on my deposit? Why are my transaction fees so high? You don't get to ask those questions in the bank. If you go to a bank with 200 rand to open a deposit, they'll treat you one way. If you go with 200 million rand to open a deposit, you get taken to Arabella and on the yacht. Money is not equal for everybody. The bank is an asymmetrical box which treats people differently. Decentralization basically disassembles that entire trip because the copy of the thing that provides you with the service is sent out to many, many, many computers around the world. That's the basis of the blockchain.
Sure.
You can see it. It's open. It's open source. It can be checked. It can't be fooled. It can't be counterfeited. It can't be upended. That is what decentralization does for you.
So I'm going to read a little bit from the prologue of Beyond Bitcoin, because I think this really summarizes a lot of what you are arguing in this book, and then maybe we can unpack that in a little bit of detail. So if you just bear with me for a second, I really thought this was interesting, and I'd like to read this particular section. You state that great fortunes will be made and lost in its, being DeFi's, wake. Staid and storied institutions will have to shed warm skins, I like this description, in a painful shudder of reinvention. Two, it will make the startling trillion-dollar rise of Bitcoin look pedestrian by comparison. And Stephen, you've already mentioned that. Three, it will disrupt and displace fine and respectable companies, if not entire industries, along with careers and skills. Four, it will make life easier and fairer and less expensive for the rest of us. And I want to delve a bit further into that as well. You've touched on it already, Stephen. Five, it will affect everyone on earth who has ever had a bank account, a credit card, a debit card, a loan, an insurance policy, or a lawyer, to say nothing of investors, artists, and traders, and anyone else who would wish to transact globally without the inertia of inscrutable and private bureaucracies. And six, and lastly, it will reinforce the cogs and wheels in the engines of trust. In other words, you guys believe that this is going to change the world fundamentally, reinvent capitalism, possibly undermine the nation state, and forever change the affairs of man. Simon, isn't this the sort of stuff that leads to world wars?
Not necessarily, no. I think, as with most big shifts in human history, we like to think of them as revolutions, but they're actually evolutions because behaviorally these things take a very long time to adopt. And there are various analogies one could draw. I think one close to you and my heart, Duncan, would be if you look at the rise of open source software in Linux.
Sure.
If we cast our minds back to the late 90s, early 2000s, I'm not sure if you remember Microsoft's advertising campaign called Get the Facts, where they spent millions of dollars putting up billboards and spreading advertorial around how rubbish Linux was and how if you adopted Linux in your organization, that you would have a support problem and it wasn't secure, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of FUD, really. Skip forward two decades and arguably the best place to get Linux on the planet right now is by downloading Windows 11, because you'll get the Windows subsystem for Linux and the full Linux kernel as part of Windows. So, there's those phases of a revolution that we always talk about, where first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win. And Linux and open source have kind of made it through that whole process. And now the Microsofts of the world have embraced it. But there were a lot of companies who, like Microsoft, were resisting, you know, Linux and open source software 2 decades ago and dug their heels in and refused to acknowledge where things were going. And they really aren't around anymore. We don't really talk about them. You know, they're now selling like databases at best. and you know who I'm alluding to, but
I do.
But I really think that's the story of new disruptive technology and how it gets imbibed, if you will, by an industry. And what blockchain is at right now is somewhere between the laugh at us and fight us stage. but we're seeing some financial institutions who see the writing on the wall, like Microsoft eventually did, and are incorporating this new technology and looking at what it means for them. And so as one example, Visa is experimenting with settlement using the USDC stablecoin on Ethereum, for example. You know, a lot of major banks now have cryptocurrency teams looking at how they can do their own products in the space. You know, on the extreme end, you've got banks like Silvergate in the US that has full on crypto custody and exchange solutions as part of their conventional banking. So, you know, our the title of our book, ending with the end of banks, is provocative. If we had made it the end of banking as you know it, but it's more complicated than that, it wouldn't have made for a very catchy sort of standard exclusive books. but that's really what's implied is it's the end of banking as we know it. So, you know, it is the end of banks. It is the end of banks the way you know them. That doesn't mean that intermediaries are going away. It doesn't mean that, you know, the brands that we know in the banking sector today are necessarily going away, but it means that they're now forced to change. Just like there were newspapers that resisted the internet and they're gone now. And there were others that embraced it and they're still around, like the New York Times. And there are new brands that have come up like Monocle in the world of newspapers that really were born into the 21st, you know, internet century. And have redefined what it means to be a newspaper. Well, now we've got banks like Investec that are embracing cryptocurrency and looking at how they can launch their own services. We've got others with red and green logos that are fighting the tide. And who knows, maybe they won't be around 2 decades from now. And we've got brand new institutions like Luno and Vela that are redefining what it means to be a financial institution or a trusted intermediary. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we're trying to capture in that line, that very provocative line about the end of banks, is that the world is changing, and there are companies that get it and are with the program, and there are others that are fighting and probably won't be around for much longer.
Yeah. I mean, it's clear that both of you believe that a big disruption is coming, a major disruption is coming. But Stephen, maybe if you can just unpack for us over the next couple of minutes, how you see that disruption unfolding. What's it going to look like, and who's going to win and who's going to lose?
Okay, so as I said earlier, the three biggest financial sectors, perhaps four, that are under threat are, I should add a fifth one, but let me start with the first four, are the banks, the people who manage your money, who allow you to deposit, who loan money out to you, who facilitate your payments, who sell you other bits and pieces, but mainly who handle your loans and deposits. That's at the core of the bank. The spread of interest rates between loans and deposits, or between credit and debit in a bank, is their profit to a large extent. And the second is the exchanges, where you pay a lot of money to brokers in the middle who carve off pieces of the transaction, find you a buyer for the stock that you want to sell, and the trade is made. There are now DeFi exchanges, a lot of them. They're called DEXs, decentralized exchanges, in which the commissions are orders of magnitude less than the commission that you'll find on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange or through a broker that attaches to the stock exchange. The third one is insurance companies. There's a whole juggernaut coming at the insurance companies, because in terms of an asymmetric black box, insurance companies are even worse than the banks. You have no idea what goes on there. You can't see the actuarial tables. You can't argue the claim, argue the premiums that you're being charged. You have to argue the claim. If they have doubt about it, there are very asymmetric black boxes. Mm-hmm. And the insurance DeFi projects like Nexus Mutual, to which we devote a chapter in the book, has taken this concept of decentralized, permissionless, trustless blockchain and implemented an insurance solution, which is absolutely radical compared to what has been in place for hundreds of years. The fourth area are the derivatives markets. I mention them only because the derivatives markets are the largest financial market in the world by one measure, which we mentioned in the book. It is a quadrillion $1 trillion, large, the biggest financial market in the world in terms of value locked. And the derivatives markets are falling very neatly into the DeFi protocols. And there is a DeFi protocol called DIDX and another one called Synthetics that deal with derivatives. And the fifth one, who has much to lose, is the nation state. And that's where the complexity lies. I'm not fully answering your question, but just let me cover the fifth one.
Yeah.
It is the central banks who control the money supply in a country in order so that prices don't rise and employment. The two jobs of a central bank is keep prices down, keep employment high. That's, those are the two jobs, and the tools that they have to do that is raise and lower interest rates or inject or retract liquidity in the market. Those are the two tools that they have. They see a parallel system being born, stable coins particularly, and they are trying to react now with things called central bank digital currencies, which Simon can get into in a little while, but they have a lot to lose. So your original question, which I return to now, is where are these disruptions happening and how? They're happening specifically in those industries with DeFi. There are other industries which are getting displaced, upended, and upset by the NFT world. Mm. Not only the art market, but the entire market of ownership is changes with NFT, which is simply a secure digital certification of ownership. It's a title deed. But leaving that aside, because that's a whole other podcast to NFTs.
Sure.
Those are the five areas where there will be disruption. And I just want to turn up the volume on what Simon said earlier. It's not a real revolution where these industries fall off the edge of the cliff because it's DeFi. It's an evolution in which they see the disruption coming. Some of them open up, bring it in, make it worthwhile to the customers, keep their call centers and customer support and marketing and all the things that we love. While others say this is absolute rubbish and kryptonite, they fall off the cliffy, and you'll see quite a lot of that in the next couple of years.
Interesting. So let me pick up on that fifth point and CDBCs and specifically, since you've mentioned it, I was going to come to it later in the discussion, but let's chat about it now. There seems to be a bit of a pushback to private money, if I can call it that, the rise of cryptocurrency, Simon. Central bank digital currency seem to me to be some sort of answer by nation states to compete with this private money that's emerging. How do you see this playing out? And I guess that's where my question about war came in as well, because, you know, if you're starting to affect the interests of the nation state has a monopoly over violence in many respects, could kick back. Could that lead to war? I guess that's where my question on that was coming from. But focusing on CDBCs, what are governments trying to do? What are central banks trying to do with these things? And do you think at some point they're going to say, well, actually, we've got CDBCs. We don't need this private money. We're going to ban it.
Yeah, you know, it's really a mixed bag, Duncan, depending on which central bank you're talking about. Right. You know, in the context of China, digital renminbi is very much centered on surveillance and control and all of the things you would expect from the Chinese government.
Yep.
In a place like South Africa, it's a fair more, you know, far more nuanced and open and frankly better thought through scenario, more freedom loving, if you will. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, they're both bad ideas in the implementation, and I'll tell you why. It's that there's a fundamental misunderstanding of the technology. And unfortunately, and this is not really the fault of the central banks themselves. They're getting very bad advice from, you know, would-be management consultants, et cetera, who always give terrible technology advice, no matter who it's to, because they don't understand the technology themselves. They're not involved with it. They just jump onto whatever the buzzword of the day is. And at the moment, it's blockchain. So firstly, To describe a central bank digital currency as digital is kind of strange, because they already are. The dollar is already digital. The rand is already digital. You know, outside of the very tiny cash reserves floating around, our currencies are already digital. You know, when the South African banking system issues new rand, it's done on a computer terminal. So I don't know how that's not digital. But when it comes to implementing blockchain technology, that's just a very poor understanding of technology. Because, you know, as you alluded to in an earlier question to Stephen, blockchain has these fundamental principles around being censorship proof, permissionless, and trustless, right? And without getting into them too deeply, because I think Stephen did a good overview, you know, the important one is the last one, the trustlessness, which doesn't mean that, you know, we've replaced trusted intermediaries in the system necessarily. It means that trust doesn't actually enter into it because it isn't required. The mantra in Bitcoin is don't trust verify. Go and look at the code yourself. Go and look at the transaction ledger. It's completely transparent and you can go and see every transaction that's happened in the history of Bitcoin all the way back to the first time that Satoshi Nakamoto sent Halfini some Bitcoin on that famous day in 2009. It's all there. It's all transparent. So you don't need to trust anyone. You can go and verify it for yourself. Now, to create this trustless network, it requires a lot of resources because banks and financial intermediaries, these are expensive businesses to run.
Yeah.
You know, the trust network in the traditional financial world consumes a lot of resources and you're not going to replace them, you know, with something powered by rainbows. It takes a lot of resources to replace them. And so famously in Bitcoin, you've got proof of work consensus or Nakamoto consensus where we're using a lot of compute resources to replace those trusted intermediaries. Now you're taking that technology designed to run without central authorities and trusted intermediaries, and you're introducing trusted intermediaries and central authorities into its network, basically making all of that compute resource redundant.
Mm-hmm.
So conceptually, it's just nonsensical. You know, it's like going, we need to have an internal combustion engine that runs on carrot juice. It can't work. It's not how internal combustion works. And so I think it's really a manifestation of how, unfortunately, central banks are getting bad advice and don't understand technology. They don't need a blockchain. They probably need MySQL and, you know, a better understanding of, I don't know, whatever the latest technology is.
But are they doing this because they see Bitcoin and other private money, other cryptocurrencies as a threat to what they do?
I think that's true to a degree. But I also think they see the opportunity to control more. They're regulators. Their job is to regulate. And at the heart of regulation is control. And so they see an opportunity to really dial that up to 11. And that scares me somewhat because if you look at what China's doing explicitly and what the others are doing implicitly, mm-hmm. that becomes an Orwellian nightmare. You know, if you speak to, people working on these projects in South Africa, they have fantastic intent. You know, they want to stamp out corruption and they want to make welfare more streamlined and efficient. And, you know, the intent is pure and noble. But what they're creating is a very dangerous system if it falls into the wrong hands, because, you know, now you can switch off people's bank accounts. You can decide where they can spend their money. In the context of the digital renminbi, the Chinese government is going to tie this into their social credit score. So if you've misbehaved, we can just lock your bank account or make it impossible for you to spend money on airline tickets or whatever we want to do. So as with all surveillance technology, I don't have a problem with the technology itself. It's fantastic. I don't have a problem with the intent. It's noble. You know, surveillance cameras on every street corner make us all safer. They undeniably do. The problem is what you're enabling when it falls into the wrong hands.
Yeah.
You know, what if the Nazis had the ability to turn bank accounts on and off and control where you were allowed to pay for things in Germany in the 30s and 40s, you know? It would have been a nightmare for a sector of the population that they had decided were persona non grata. So that's what concerns me, is not what CBDCs are in their intent today, which is noble, but what they become if they're built effectively. Fortunately, none of them are. They're all a little bit ass about face at the moment, if we're honest.
Well, they've been built by consultants. What do you expect? Stephen, I mean, we've seen what happened to Facebook's Libra project, effectively killed off by regulatory scrutiny and regulators not happy about Facebook building its own private money. Do you think that the emergence of DeFi technology could be constrained by regulators and by governments who are scared of what's coming?
Yes, the word constrained is loaded because it has a kind of a negative pejorative. With absolute certainty, the DeFi space will be regulated by governments, and that is not altogether a bad thing.
Okay.
So most of the rational people in the DeFi space are looking for rational regulation. In order so that the institutions can offer these services, which are, again, better, faster, cheaper, and fairer, to citizens like us. Mm. And that sort of regulation is a requirement and a necessity of a state. The danger is that the governments will see this as a way to increase their own power and decrease the power of the private citizen, which is what happens now. and use those regulations to do that. You see this in America right now with Elizabeth Warren in particular, who wants to regulate this thing to the extent to which it becomes a paper tiger and is not usable and they get to see everything. The whole, as Simon said, the whole point behind, well, not the whole point, one of the key ingredients of the fuel of blockchain is that you can't censor it, you can't oversee it. It is private transactions between private people, and not only private people, they are not going to be identified as human beings. They are numbers that you carry around with you. And that's what cash is, essentially. And what governments are trying to do with, some governments are trying to do with the regulation, is to pull that out of it and regulate it so that you have to say who you are and you can't do it privately. It's part of the fuel of this whole cryptocurrency thing, was to be able to do this privately without any oversight, and certainly. So I think that regulation, you know, I have sort of probably a sad and optimistic belief that people are rational and that most governments will come together and form a regulatory regime which will make sense to this technology.
And if it doesn't, if they don't?
Well, if they don't and people decide to use the technology illegally, okay, that's if they don't. A bunch of laws are passed, a bunch of regulations are passed, they are irrational. It will continue because who are they going to put in jail? The stuff is decentralized. There are no human beings associated with. There are no corporations. There are no hierarchical organizations that you can go sue and in jail. So this thing continues as a parallel and illegal thing. But I don't think that will happen. It's not in anybody's interests for that to happen, including the nation states.
Including the nation state. But what does this actually mean, Stephen, for the nation state in the longer term? And what are the broader, and I know I'm kind of hopping back to the same topic again, but what are the broader geosocial and geopolitical implications of DeFi? What is it going to do to the world over the next few decades?
There are a whole bunch of them. You know, you can look at different silos. Let me just choose one, which is money flow, velocity of money. One of the reasons that banks are allowed to loan out capital multiple times, depending on the bank and jurisdiction, between 10 and 20 times, it's called fractional reserve banking, is they want to increase money in the economy. They want to have a lot of money flowing because it creates wealth. The blockchain settles in the case of Bitcoin, it's about 10 minutes. In the case of Ethereum, it's 15 seconds. In the case of some of the newer blockchains, it's much lower than that. That speed of settlement of money takes out the enormous industry of party-counterparty risk. There's a whole industry around counterparty risk because it doesn't settle immediately. So you have a slow movement of money because you're always waiting for the other party to settle their side, and the banks, as your intermediary, ensure that settlement. With a proper blockchain technology supporting a financial economy, you get immediate settlement at about 1,000 times the speed. I've heard on one podcast by Caitlin Long, 1,000 times the speed settlement right now. So one of the things that we do to the nation state, if it's properly regulated and properly put out there, they get 1,000 times increase in the velocity of money with the wealth creation certainty that will bring. That's just looking on the pure monetary side. There are other silos that you can look at which will be vastly catalyzed if they do this thing properly. One is the pure innovation around this thing called cryptography. Just let me talk about that for a second.
Sure.
One of the unknown gifts of this entire technology is a series of cryptographic algorithms, which were basically invented in the mid-70s, which allowed things called digital signatures, hashing, uncrackable encryptions. None of this stuff existed before blockchain. I mean, there was encryption, but it's at a new level now. Those technologies open up a huge slew of industries. Let me give you an example of one that Simon brought up in an early podcast that we did, the concept of streaming money. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me give you the use case, then you'll understand what streaming money is. You're walking along a dark street, and there's a street light over there. As you enter that street light, you start getting charged for the time that you're in the light, and as you drop out the other side, you stop getting charged even more than that. Somebody else walks into the street light at the same time as you, and the system, the blockchain system behind it, knows this, and you split the costs of the light. All of that is enabled by this underlying plumbing and the programmability of blockchains like Ethereum. could go on and on, but there are many silos which get fueled and catalyzed into new industries, and those governments who realize that will take a light hand.
Interesting. So, Simon, let's come back to banks, because it is the title of the book, after all. You say the banks are either going to adapt to this or they're going to die. But let's say the banks adapt. What do they look like in the future? What will a traditional bank of today look like in this new world of DeFi? And if you were advising an F&B or a Standard Bank or an Absa or a Capitec or an Investec, what would you tell their management team they should be thinking about around DeFi and where their institutions are likely to be going in the coming years and coming decades?
It's interesting, Duncan, because in a way it takes banks back to what they used to be in the past, which is a fairly simple organization that are custodians of something valuable. And in this context, it would be, you know, storing private keys to blockchain balances on behalf of their clients.
And doing
very little else. You know, I think we've kind of seen this rebundling of financial services that's been happening in a lot of the developed world. And in South Africa, we've seen banks trying to be everything from, you know, cellular networks to insurers to the place you get your laptop from. And I think a lot of that is gonna start falling away as they are forced to refocus on their core competency of custody and trust. And I think it's really that simple. I personally don't need a bank for much at the moment.
Sure.
Unfortunately, I have to pay in rands, and so I need a card that I can do that with. Mm-hmm. But if I need to take out a loan at the moment, I can take out a fully collateralized loan against the cryptocurrency that I hold. So I don't need banks for loans increasingly. If I need insurance for something, there's still a lot of things that I will only get underwriting from in the traditional financial world, but increasingly you're seeing protocols like Nexus Mutual fill that hole as well. So increasingly I don't need them for risk. So a lot of the core things that a bank does, I don't need them for, including payments. Like the Bitcoin Lightning Network is just absolutely mind bogglingly good at replacing all of our existing payment systems. It's faster. It's cheaper. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, everything a good innovation has, it removes steps from a process. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is that removing payments from financial institutions is actually a gift for a lot of them. Payments are a swear word. It's something they kind of have to do more for marketing than anything else, but it's a terrible business. You know, it's really hard to make money in payments. It's a nightmare, actually. I think a lot of banks would be quite happy if they weren't involved in payments and they were just custodians. So I think you're seeing a lot of those services being offloaded into these networks and to kind of varying size of relief depending on which financial institution you're speaking to.
I'd like
just to add to that, you know, what all the banks look like in the future. There is a role to banks play in at least in the short to medium term in one important aspect. These DeFi protocols are complex and their user interfaces are mediocre. The user experience is sometimes quite terrifying, even for people like us who know our way around this thing. If you press a wrong button, you can lose a lot of money. Mm-hmm. There's all that sort of stuff. And just to understand some of them, because some of them are built in, you know, arcane and Rube Goldian ways, and the stuff that they do is difficult to do. And you have to be somewhat of an expert in the DeFi space to go play in there. You've got to have big cojones to do this.
Right.
The banks will play the role of an intermediary who will guide you and do this for you, or bank-like companies. They will say to you, listen, I've got this protocol over here. You give me your rands, and I will give you 17% return just within 10 seconds. But you don't have to worry about how it works. And I'm your trusted bank. You've trusted me for, you know, 50 years. Mm-hmm. We'll get that done for you. Then the retail, particularly the retail customer, doesn't have to worry about going into the interfaces where there's strange words and jargon is never understood. For the medium term, the banks will play that role, including customer service and marketing and all the other things.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. They need to provide the user experience for a lot of these things, because the reality is that most people don't have the time, patience, the interest to learn how to do these things themselves.
Yeah.
I think the interesting thing is that banks become optional, whereas now banks are, you know, they're a necessity if you're going to be a human being in a modern society, whereas in the future they become optional and most people will still choose to have a bank. But that'll because that's because they need a better user interface for this stuff, not because they absolutely have to have one.
Are we kind of in the early 1990s equivalent of the internet now, and then the World Wide Web came along in the mid-1990s, and we're waiting for the equivalent of the World Wide Web to arrive to make all of this usable and functional and so that people can really understand it?
I think that's exactly accurate, yes.
Yeah, you know, I often think back to that era, Duncan, of like, you know, 1998, just before the dot-com bubble burst in 99. Yeah. Mm. And I think what people forget is that, you know, Apple was around back then. Amazon were around back then. Google was there. Microsoft were there. It's not like those companies went away when the bubble burst. The bubble bursting actually gave them the room to define themselves. And now they're bigger than they've ever been. You know, Apple's approaching a $3 trillion market cap. So it's not like Apple died when the dot-com bubble burst. Yeah. In a way, the bubble bursting was the beginning of the industry. It wasn't the end of it.
You're right.
And I think crypto is running up that hill, and it's going to have its dot-com moment. There's now this Cambrian explosion of all of these startups and blockchains and protocols and projects and the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think its dot-com moment will come. There'll be a little bit of a collapse. A lot of these projects will be driven to extinction, and a lot of them will still be around 20 years from now. And really that'll be the time in which they define themselves. But I think your analogy is exactly right. This isn't very user-friendly yet. It's the Wild West. We're kind of camping in the desert, as Mark Shuttleworth is, you know, famously fond of saying. Yeah. It's a frontier town. You know, this is the gold rush.
If there is going to be a bit of a bubble and a crash, where is that bubble going to inflate? Is it going to be in the value of crypto tokens? Is it going to be in stock market listings on the NASDAQ like it was in 2000? Where's that bubble going to inflate?
All of the above, and driven a lot by VCs, because as with the dot-com bubble, they are pouring, you know, more good money is chasing bad in this space than has ever been available to the world, because we've printed 80% of the dollars in existence over the last 2 years. So we've got infinite dollars chasing finite assets. And a lot of that, because of the structure of the US economy, has ended up with completely clueless venture capitalists that are going to waste billions of dollars in the space and pump it up in the process. Stephen.
Just to give you a feel for some numbers about this, the dot-com crash is a big word. The reckoning that will be coming. Let me just call it that way.
All right.
There are somewhere around, I think at last count, I haven't looked for a long time, a couple of thousand cryptocurrencies out there. And at the top of the pile is Bitcoin and Ethereum and Solana and some of the ones that some of your listeners would know.
Sure.
There are, in terms of DeFi projects, which are projects that are offering different flavors of loan deposit projects or different flavors of decentralized exchanges, even a couple of different flavors of insurance companies and derivatives, there are hundreds of them. And there are new ones every single day. You know, because we're in this field now and we do a lot of our, you know, professional lives are around this DeFi, we spend a lot of the time, Simon and me separately, staring at news feeds all day as the stuff arrives. And to try and keep up with the daily sort of tsunami of new projects, and on top of that, the daily tsunami of venture capital money chasing those new projects, is a full-time job on itself. It's unsustainable.
Yeah.
If I have to make a prediction, and I won't be any more foolish than to say that sometime in the near future, many of these DeFi initiatives will shrivel, and many of those cryptocurrencies have already stopped growing. They're already worth almost nothing. And there will be 10, perhaps 15 ones that have utility in different ways that will be worth investing in. There will be 10, 15, 20 different DeFi type initiatives that will have the market share and everybody else won't be there. But that doesn't mean that the industry collapses, because there are still the same amount of people who want to put their funds into this new technology.
How far away is this reckoning?
So, I mean, let's look at some numbers, because if you look at the height of the dot-com bubble, right, late 1999 or whenever it was, the market capitalization of all of the companies that fell into that sector on the US stock markets was roughly $8 trillion, if I remember correctly. Correct me if I'm wrong, Duncan. And famously, $5 trillion of value was lost in the burst.
Yes.
And if you look at the entire crypto industry right now, and that's $1,999, by the way. So if you related it to today, you could, you know,
quite a bit more.
You could put a multiplier on it. Mm-hmm. If you look at the entire crypto industry, is worth less than $3 trillion at the time that we're recording this podcast. So, you know, roughly a third of the money in $1,999. So probably even less than that if you related to today.
And worth less than Apple currently. I mean, Apple's on 2.8.
Exactly. The entire industry is worth less than Apple. You know, it's about on par with Microsoft, I think.
Right.
So there's still so much room for growth. I think it's still actually so early, which sounds crazy because, you know, it's been 13 years for those of us who have been in the industry since the beginning, but it really is still early and there really is a lot of room for growth. And also, if you look at what the dot-com bubble meant and what dot-com companies back then were doing, you know, it wasn't quite as revolutionary as reshaping the global financial system,
which is, selling pet food.
What cryptocurrency is doing. Yeah, exactly. It was pets.com and Jeff Bezos losing hair and selling books. And so I'm not saying it wasn't meaningful and profound, but really, if you look at what crypto's very audacious goals are, I think there's still a lot of room for this bubble to expand into before we see it coming anywhere near popping.
Right. And it did take 25 years of the internet before the web came along.
Exactly. Yeah. It took a long time for us to decide what this technology meant. And really, I see this as a continuation of that movement because if you think about the internet and the various waves that defined it, the first one was really the web, the World Wide Web, brought on by HTTP as a protocol that enabled it. The second wave to me was the mobile wave, brought on by the iPhone and the, you know, the reimagining of the smartphone industry. Mm. And that to me was the second wave. And to me, Web3 is the third wave. Decentralization of the web is the really the big third wave. So in a way we're kind of still in the same waters you know, that the internet brought us in the early 90s.
I wanted to come back to a point you mentioned when we were talking about banks, and clearly one of their big roles and one of the most profitable roles for many banks is that of lending. They're often referred to as lenders. You mentioned that you, Simon, don't need the bank to loan you money anymore because you have ways of lending money. Can you just maybe expand a little bit on what you meant by that and whether you see the role of traditional banks as lenders going away at some point?
Mm, absolutely. So what's very popular at the moment, especially in the Ethereum ecosystem, is lending from protocols like Compound or Aave, where you can use your cryptocurrency as collateral. I think that's another thing that a lot of people don't understand about cryptocurrency holders at the moment. They think that we're all speculators and traders and trying to get rich quick. What they don't understand is is that we're our own banks and we're never going to sell our tokens because we don't have to.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is we have these protocols like Compound or Aave. So let's use a practical example. Let's say I need 50,000 rand to pay my bills this month and I, you know, don't have any money in the bank and I have to access it from the world of crypto. I can take one Ethereum, which is worth about 50,000 rand at the moment. I can go to Compound and I can give the protocol my Ethereum as collateral. And then I can lend out up to the full value of that collateral. I probably don't want to take the full amount so that I don't get liquidated. We won't get into the technicalities of that, but I want to ideally be over collateralized, which is fairly simple to understand. And I take out a loan in a stable coin from that protocol. And I go and I cash that out to Luno or Vela. So I've got 50,000 rand in my bank account and I can go and pay my bills. What's happening is the Ethereum that I put into that protocol, I still have a token that represents that collateral. And my Ethereum is now locked into Compound's market. So Compound can go and lend my Ethereum out, to other people. And I will pay interest on the loan that I've taken out in the stable coin that I've chosen to do it in, but I'll also earn interest on my collateral, which is being lent out to other users. I'll also earn Compound's own token, their governance token. I will earn incrementally the longer that the loan is there for. So I'm incentivized to almost keep the loan, you know, going for a little bit longer so that I can earn that. And by the way, this is all metered by the second. So I can take out the loan for minutes if I wanted to, and the interest would be calculated on based on that time frame, and so would my rewards. Mm. There's also the concept of flash loans, which is mind blowing. We'll maybe get into that later. So now off I go, pay my bills. My Ethereum is earning me a little bit of income and I'm paying interest that probably offsets it and then some. Skip forward a year and let's imagine that the price of Ethereum has climbed to 150,000 Rand. So it's been a phenomenal year and Ethereum's now worth three times what it was. Well, I can go and settle my loan and buy back my Ethereum for the price I took the loan out at. So I can go and pay back 50,000 rands worth of stablecoin and get my Ethereum back, which is now worth 150,000 rand. Or I can go and lend out more because my collateral is worth more now. So now I can go and lend another 50,000 rand to pay next month's bills or, you know, whatever the case may be. Conversely, if Ethereum has lost its value and it's now worth only, you know, 25,000 rand, so 50% of its value has been lost, I can just walk away from my loan and I'll be liquidated and my collateral's gone. So be it. But really, I can do this all without a financial institution, without an intermediary, without having to sell my crypto, if you will, and on my own speed, my own terms. And that's just one way that you can do loans on the blockchain. There's some loan protocols where they aren't collateralized at all, and the community decides whether or not you are a good borrower, and you have a rating system like Uber where, you know, it's out of whatever the metric is, and that decides what your interest rates are. They're flash loans where you don't need any collateral. You get a free loan so long as you pay it back with interest in a single block of transactions. We can maybe get into the technicalities of that because it's fairly mind blowing. So there are various ways that this can be done, but none of them involve a financial intermediary.
Just to add to this, there's a transaction I'm involved in now as a Simon. I owe money, quite a lot of money. I have Ether lodged. I am going to borrow against that Ether at the interest rate of 0%. Let's repeat that. I'm taking out a very large loan at 0%. My only cost is 0.62%, the value of the loan, a one-time cost of 0.62%. I'm taking out the cash. I'm giving it to my creditor. Done. And it takes all of 15 seconds to do this, literally. You put that in front of a traditional banker, and they're going to fall over.
But banks, 0% loan. Banks are traditionally, and not traditionally, they are very heavily regulated because to a large extent, they're there to protect consumers. I imagine a lot of the stuff that's happening in the DeFi world is at the consumer's risk. Or am I missing the point here?
Yes, it is at the consumer's risk. Mm. But the what they're protecting the consumers against in the traditional finance world is a long and sizzling history of theft in the financial world. You just go back to 1929 and the stock market crash and the shenanigans were there. But they're protecting the consumers against bad actors. There is consumer risk within the DeFi world. It is a different kind of risk. There is a risk that the underlying protocol, which is a piece of code, has a bug in it. That's the biggest risk at all. And that some bad guy will see the bug and drain the accounts. Right. That has happened. Mm-hmm. But there's a difference in the profile of the risks. I want to talk about this for a second because a lot of people, you know, read about crime in DeFi. It turns out that it is fairly difficult to commit a crime in the world of DeFi and not be noticed. And that's because it's an open ledger. So as soon as you steal coins, they end up in a wallet and hundreds of thousands of eyes are now trained on that wallet to see where that money moves. And in fact, most of the people who've stolen money in DeFi have been caught, the money's been returned. In the world of traditional finance, none of this exists. There's a single example that I like to give. In January last year, a Danish and Estonian bank conspired to steal $300 billion in one day, $300 billion in one couple of hour period on behalf of a bunch of Russian oligarchs. And they did it quietly. And it was reported later, but not too much fanfare. Somebody steals a couple of million dollars in DeFi, it's all over the news. Mm. The world, if you want to commit crime, you do it in the world of traditional finance, not in the world of cryptocurrency. So yes, there is risk, but it's not the same sort of risk as in the traditional world.
Very interesting. I was actually going to ask about the illicit flow of money because the banks always put themselves forward as gatekeepers. And I mean, we've seen it in the case of the Gupta corruption and the role the banks have been playing in closing bank accounts and preventing that illicit flow of funds. Are you saying that the crooks won't simply move across to DeFi and cryptocurrencies and other non-traditional forms of finance to launder their money?
Simon, I can jump in there, Duncan.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about cryptocurrency is a lot of, especially politicians who really don't understand the space or the technology or anthropology or people or anything seemingly, have you know, suggested that, that crypto is God's gift to criminals. And actually, it's quite the opposite for several reasons.
Okay.
Firstly, when you transact, you have to do so in the real world with real people. And so, for example, if you look at what's currently happening at the time of recording with the Russia's illegal invasion of the Ukraine, a lot of politicians in the West suggested that Russians might use cryptocurrency to evade sanctions. And we're just not seeing that happen. And the reason is that it doesn't matter that they can get their money into Bitcoin or Ethereum. That might help them, you know, get away from the erosion of value in their state currency. But they still can't transact with anybody, you know. Ruble. But Bitcoin is an oligarch in the UK now because people won't sell it to them. They're sanctioned. So whether they're paying with Bitcoin or ham sandwiches or rubles doesn't matter. Nobody wants their money, so they're not going to take it from them. So, you know, that's not happening. What is happening is that the Ukrainian government has tweeted out its own Bitcoin and Ethereum addresses to raise funds from the world and has, I haven't checked today, but as of yesterday morning, raised $150 million in donations from the world. Not only that, but 60% of their suppliers have been willing to accept crypto from the Ukrainian government in exchange for bulletproof vests, helmets, tourniquets, lunch packs, you know, the kind of defensive equipment that they feel is ethical to be buying with that money. It's been a beautiful example of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency being used for something very positive and not being God's gift to people fleeing sanctions and to criminals. You know, as Stephen was alluding to, and as he said, you know, the traditional financial system is where you want to be as a criminal. It's opaque. Nobody can spy on you, including authorities. It's very easy to hide money and launder money and make it look like you're doing business when you aren't. Cash is fantastic. You know, if you're a Mexican drug lord, you can plaster it into your walls and bury it in your garden and pack it into suitcases. And in fact, HSBC redesigned their teller kiosks in Mexico famously in the 90s so that they were the exact size of a Samsonite carry-on case so that drug lords could literally hand cash over through, you know, over into their bank accounts. And yes, they get fined for it, whatever.
But what about, but really, what about privacy focus? What about privacy focused cryptocurrencies like Monero, for example? Is that not where the criminals are going?
I mean, they might be inclined to. That's where we are seeing regulators and exchanges stepping in and delisting a lot of those privacy coins.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of utility for privacy coins because if you're a hedge fund, for example, and you want to make a transaction into something where your competitors aren't able to survey you, privacy coins are a very good reason to, you know, or a very good way to do that. So privacy coins have utility as well. And we can have a philosophical discussion about whether or not privacy is a sort of a human right, you know, for the same reason that we have doors on public toilets, you should be able to do some transactions in privacy. But even there, there's an eventual output that's traceable. And there are, you know, firms like Chain Analysis and Elliptical that even if you're using Zcash or Monero, they might not be able to see all the hops in between, but they'll still be able to catch you on the in and outs of the network. So I think those privacy coins exist in a kind of a Goldilocks zone for privacy for me, where, you know, they're not going to make it so easy that your friends can snoop on your transactions and cause you trouble for doing something that they might think is, you know, whatever, touchy. But if authorities want to trace your transactions, they'll still be able to do so with a privacy coin, probably more easily than they would be able to through the traditional banking system. So, I think, but with the exception of privacy coins, which actually have, if you look at their market capitalizations, they don't have the level of adoption.
No, they don't.
Nowhere near the level of a Bitcoin or an Ethereum. There have been forensic audits on blockchain activity. And if you look at the percentage of transactions in the crypto world that can be attributed to crime, it's infinitesimally smaller as a proportion than what you see in the traditional financial system.
As we're almost out of time, but I wanted to just squeeze in one last question for both of you. I think a lot of people have heard, at least heard of the term decentralized finance by now. But I think a lot of people, you know, haven't even invested in their first cryptocurrency investment, and they kind of hear all this terminology flying around, and they might read your book and say, well, you know, the world is changing. How much attention should your ordinary guy, the guy who owns a local spa, for example, or, you know, your mother, anybody, how much attention should someone be paying to this stuff? I mean, the suggestion in your book is that this is fundamentally going to change the world. Does the ordinary man in the street need to be paying much more attention to this stuff than they are at the moment, in your view, Simon?
You know, I think the answer, in short, is not necessarily. You know, the normal person in the street is going to end up adopting this stuff sooner or later, just like they ended up with a smartphone sooner or later, without knowing how smartphones worked or how significant the announcement of the iPhone was at the time necessarily.
Sure.
But I do think that for many people, there's an intellectual curiosity, you know, and I think particularly for your audience, there's a lot of interesting opportunities here. Both for individuals and for organizations. And I do think that if you work in the financial industry or any industry adjacent to it, which is everything, this is going to touch you in some way. And so whether you have the intellectual curiosity or not, it's probably worth finding out or deciding for yourself what it might mean for you or your business or your industry. Mm. So I think from that perspective, absolutely, this is something that we're all going to be using in the future, I believe. It's endlessly fascinating, which is why people like Stephen and I are inclined to write books about it.
We could talk all afternoon on this podcast about it. It really is a fascinating subject. Yeah, yeah. But Stephen, carry on.
Yeah, so I have a beautiful use case to prove this example of people using this. It is true that for the average man on the street now, it seems as though this technology is too surrounded by jargon and complex interfaces, and the technology is inscrutable. It seems like that would be a barrier, but I must just point you to El Salvador. El Salvador legalized Bitcoin. El Salvador's population is not educated. It's very much like rural El Salvador. Is very much like rural South Africa. They're very low levels of education. People don't finish school. 60% of the citizens there learned how to download a wallet onto their phone, learned how to use the wallet, pay for their goods with Bitcoin. It's not that difficult when you get to that sort of level. If it is a larger amount than just the payment activity of using a smartphone as a payment device, by the way, one can also look at China, which is not using Bitcoin, but is using cell phones for very, very small payments. So that is the mechanism of payment. So I don't think that the technological hurdle or the jargon hurdle in the long run, if there is enough value to be had from the new service, people learn how to use it. If it is a larger amount where somebody says, you know what, I'd kind of like to put 10% of what I've saved up into cryptocurrency. I don't know anything about it. I don't want to learn this shit. I don't have the time. Then I'd suggest you phone, you know, Simon Dingle's company's Venox is built for people who want to put their funds into a managed fund, a managed crypto fund like Simon's company, or for the banks who will certainly be offering crypto assets. You don't have to learn that stuff to put money in to invest.
Thanks, Simon. Steven. Simon will checks pay, in the mail.
Yeah, Simon will be paying you in Ethereum immediately after this podcast. I was actually going to ask, just as we end, Stephen. I mean, if you've read this book and you believe that this is the future of finance, and you want to profit on it now, what should you be doing? Should you be investing in smart contract focused cryptocurrencies? What should you do as an investor?
So this is the point at which you say this is not financial advice. We don't get ourselves into trouble.
It's not with a disclaimer.
If somebody just simply wants to dip a toe in the water of cryptocurrency, buy Bitcoin and Ethereum. Yes, that's it. Those are the two market leaders. Those are not going away. And from our perspective, those are on a long-term rising price appreciation. If you want to dip your toe into DeFi, read our book.
Here it is. Beyond Bitcoin, Decentralized Finance and the End of Banks by Stephen Boyke Sidley and Simon Dingle. Gentlemen, thank you so much for sharing some of your insights. This book was well worth a read. Go grab it. It's available in your local bookstore on Audible, and it's also available as an ebook on the Kindle, right?
Kindle, take a lot, all of them, anywhere you go to get your books.
Anywhere you want to get your books.
Yeah.
Great. Simon, Stephen, thank you for your time. Much appreciated. Thank you for talking to Tech Central.